From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is away. I'm Bob Garfield. This was a busy week, controlling the message-wise, following last week's CNBC debate, deemed a debacle by the Republican presidential hopefuls and their party. The competing campaigns got together to dictate more favorable terms for ensuing encounters. GOP lawyer Ben Ginsburg drafted a list of demands that was leaked to the Washington Post.
The representatives considered a list of format demands ranging from the forms of questions and time allotments to the types of microphones and maximum temperature inside the room. That's 67 degrees, by the way.
As of this recording, no campaign had formally attached itself to the letter, but that didn't stop their demands from being roundly mocked. Fox News Channel's Megyn Kelly.
The network should commit that they will not ask hand-raising questions, yes or no questions, allow candidate-to-candidate questions, and then maybe like a foot massage or like a little...
Yes, the ridicule of control freakdom even included Fox. And presently, we shall join the chorus. But as it turns out, this year's candidate's wish for control isn't so especially freakish. Alan Schroeder is a professor at Northeastern University's School of Journalism and the author of Presidential Debates, 50 Years of High-Risk TV. He says that the candidates' desire to reduce their exposure to disaster is altogether routine.
As a debate geek who reads these documents a lot, there really wasn't anything particularly surprising on that list of demands. The one that did catch me a little off guard was candidates would have control over the on-screen graphics, the little descriptors that are shown on the screen while they're talking. And apparently that came about because Jeb Bush was unhappy that on the CNBC debate he was not listed as having been the governor of Florida. But the idea that the candidates could exercise literal editorial control over what was shown on the screen, that was a new one on me.
Rens Priebus's nominal complaint in his letter to NBC was that the questions did not give candidates an opportunity to discuss substantive policy issues. Did they strike you as being unusually superficial?
I don't think the questions were superficial or irrelevant at all. I think he was as much complaining about the shortened response times as he was about the questions themselves. If you ask a difficult or complicated question and there's 30 seconds in which to respond, that is going to make it seem unsatisfying. But you have 10 or 11 people on this stage. There's only so much you can do. I also think that Rens Priebus in his complaining is sort of an attempt to save his own skin after the fact, because the candidates are not just upset with the television networks, they're quite upset with the Republican National Committee.
Because they believe, or at least some of them do, that Priebus set them up to fail.
It goes back to this central idea that they really don't want to be there in the first place, and so they're looking for any little minimal advantage or security blanket that they might grab onto. And when things go wrong, then the impulse is to start pointing fingers. Some of these solutions that the candidates have offered, you know, Ted Cruz literally saying, we need to know that these moderators have voted Republican before they ought to be questioning us, is absurd. Or Ben Carson saying, let's do all of the debates on Facebook, is absurd.
But he who pays the piper does call the tune. These are media staged events. They're big money makers for the cable channels. Is there any reason for the media to cede control and to bow to the demands of the candidates in the Republican Party?
You know, if you go back 20 years or so, primary debates tended to be sponsored by local media, often newspapers. Sometimes they were televised, sometimes they weren't. They might get picked up on C-SPAN. But this notion that primary debates are now national television shows that are designed to attract ratings, that are designed to increase advertising rates, that's a pretty new phenomenon. And I think it puts the news networks in a kind of tricky ethical situation, because these are journalists who are supposed to be reporting about what happens on the campaign trail, who are now creating news events and in some cases finding themselves at the heart of the story.
So finally, coming back to the CNBC debate, which has raised all of these questions, relative to the 50 years of presidential debates that you have studied, Where do you think this one fits?
I don't see this as a particular watershed. I actually thought it was a little on the dull side myself. And yet it's the one that has unleashed the candidates' furies. I do think there was some snarky questioning, and I thought that there was some kind of dumb questioning, the opening question about what's your greatest weakness. That's such a cliche at this point. So I think we can fault the journalists for some of the quality of their questioning, but I don't think we can fault them for doing something that crossed a line into being inappropriate behavior on their part. What you're seeing on the part of the candidates is a lot of grandstanding, you know, especially on the Republican side. It never hurts to bash the media. And yes, the moderators handed the candidates a bit of an opportunity with which to do that, but they're going to do it anyway. So I don't know that the journalists are really the culpable parties here.
There was an answer I was hoping for to the what's your greatest weakness question. Yeah. I hoped one of them would say, well, there's actually two answers to that. The first is caring too much. Sometimes my empathy gets the better of me, and I just want to help, even though we don't really have the resources to do so. And I guess my other weakness is taking money from lobbyists to help them pass their legislation.
Yeah, I think we'd be waiting a long time for that particular response.
Alan, thank you so much.
Sure, Bob. Thank you.
Alan Schroeder is a professor at Northeastern University's School of Journalism and author of Presidential Debates, 50 Years of High-Risk TV. The list of demands for the host of the next debate was long, but the nub of the problem is nothing to do with graphics or room temperature. This week's recurring theme from the RNC and the candidates themselves was about the immoderation of the moderators. You know, those jackals who viciously attacked would-be presidents of the United States with questions, but not just any questions.
The backlash comes after angry candidates complained about so-called gotcha questions by moderators.
Those CNBC gotcha questions.
The Republican National Committee chairman says there were too many gotcha questions.
Gotcha questions, shrewdly designed by antagonistic smart alecks to unfairly elicit answers not previously tested in focus groups. Here was frontrunner Ben Carson speaking afterwards on ABC.
We should have moderators who are interested in disseminating the information about the candidates as opposed to gotcha.
Yeah, God forbid candidates for the presidency should be asked to defend their actions, policy ideas, previous statements, inconsistencies, and hollow promises. Carson, for example, was confronted by moderator Becky Quick on his vague proposal for a flat tax, which, using a partisan trick called arithmetic, she observed would add $1 trillion+ to the deficit. Carson was then forced to disseminate information.
It's not true.
And it when, is true. I looked at the numbers.
When we put all of the facts down, you'll be able to see that it's not true. It works out very well.
Oh, well, there you have it. It works out very well. Later, CNBC's Carl Quintanilla inquired about Carson's decade-long ties, including paid speaking gigs and appearances in promotional materials, to a marketer of nutritional supplements who'd been fined for making wild health claims.
I didn't have an involvement with them. That is total propaganda. I did a couple of speeches for them. I did speeches for other people. They were paid speeches. It is absolutely absurd to say that I had any kind of a relationship with them. Do I take the product? Yes. I think it's a good product.
To be fair, you were on the homepage of their website with the logo over your shoulder.
I guess it depends on your definition of relationship and of propaganda. At least he answered the question. Candidates in his position more often just changed the subject, frequently by turning the question against the journalist and the press in general. This was Texas Senator Ted Cruz following Quintanilla's question about Cruz's willingness to shut down the government over the debt limit.
You know, let me say something at the outset. The questions that have been asked so far in this debate illustrate why the American people don't trust the media. This is not a cage match. And you look at the questions. Donald Trump, are you a comic book villain? Ben Carson, can you do math? John Kasich, will you insult two people over here? Marco Rubio, why don't you resign? Jeb Bush, why have your numbers fallen? How about talking about the substantive issues people care about?
You mean an issue like the debt limit, the one you used your time not talking about? Never mind. Cruz went on to allege that a partisan cabal of closet Democrats merely wanted to make Republicans look bad.
Contrast with the Democratic debate, where every fawning question from the media was, which of you is more handsome and wise?
RNC Chairman Reince Priebus, in cutting ties with NBC, complained that the questions were designed to embarrass the candidates. Quote, the RNC's sole role in the primary debate process is to ensure that our candidates are given a full and fair opportunity to lay out their vision for America's future. Look, running against the media is a time-honored tactic. Remember Nixon's vice president, Spiro Agnew?
My target for tonight, the professional pessimist. In the United States today, we have more than our share of the nattering nabobs of negativism.
The idea is to deflect criticism by playing on voters' own suspicions about the elite quinoa-eating know-it-alls who presume to represent their interests. But since when is helping politicians make their best case to the voters the media's role? The media's role is to be a proxy for the voter by raising relevant questions about philosophy, policy, and fitness for office. As for the notion that the press is a subversive fifth column out to sabotage the Republican candidates, here's a little bit of CNN's Anderson Cooper at the first Democratic primary debate.
Secretary Clinton, I want to start with you. You were against same-sex marriage, now you're for it. You defended President Obama's immigration policies, now you say they're too harsh. You supported his trade deal dozens of times. You even called it the gold standard. Now, suddenly, last week, you're against it. Will you say anything to get elected?
Compare that with Quintanilla's much-ridiculed opening salvo for the Republicans.
What is your biggest weakness, and what are you doing to address it?
Okay, that didn't yield too much. But I myself appreciated the effort. After all, what did the pushier questions produce anyway? Certainly no sobbing confessions. And in that sense, the critics of moderator impertinence may be onto something. If recent history has taught us anything, it's that the most illuminating candidate questions aren't confrontational at all, just innocuous, open-ended, and delicious. Let's say, for instance, you suspected that a candidate for vice president was a five-alarm ignoramus.
And when it comes to establishing your worldview, I was curious, what newspapers and magazines did you regularly read before you were tapped for this to stay informed and to understand the
world?
I've
read most of them, again, with a great appreciation for the press, for the media.
But like, what ones specifically? I'm curious that you...
All of them, any of them that have been in front of me over all these years.
Gotcha. And then there's the guy who would have loved to field gotcha questions, or any questions at all, before a national audience. Lawrence Lessig, Harvard Law professor and crusader for campaign finance reform, announced this week that he is ending his run for president. Lessig explained on our show a couple of months ago that he'd be running a single-issue campaign. That issue? Campaign finance reform. And his promise was that once it had been accomplished, he would resign as president. In the last couple of weeks, when it became obvious that he wasn't getting any traction with that tactic, he renounced his resignation plan and outlined policy positions on 15 other issues, including tax reform and health care. But it was all too little, too late. Larry, welcome back to OTM.
Great to be back.
You had trouble getting traction for your message, I guess partly because you could not get in front of the voters on TV to debate the other Democratic candidates. Why was that?
I didn't get on stage because of this weird catch-22 in the rules for getting access to the debates. The rules the Democratic Party originally said was three polls finding you at 1% within 6 weeks of the debate. Now, we had some trouble originally because the polls weren't even including my name, and so I didn't make the first debate. But then coming up to the second debate, we are increasingly finding that every poll that included my name actually found me at 1%. But then last week, my manager was told by the DNC that the rule is actually three polls finding you at 1% at least 6 weeks before the debate. So there would be no way, obviously, unless we could travel through time to fix that problem.
You did manage to raise more than $1 million in 4 or 5 weeks. Martin O'Malley, who was on stage at the first debate, barely eclipsed $1 million in donations in 3 months. Jim Webb, who dropped out from the race as well, he got under $700,000. Lincoln Chafee dropped out, raised $15,000 and some change for the entire quarter. All three of them were on stage with Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. They met the 1% within 6 weeks threshold?
Yes, they did. It's different for an outsider. There's a limited window that you can run for president of the United States if you're not a billionaire or a politician. But, you know, the real issue here, in my view, isn't really the fact that I've been excluded. What's important here, I think, is that there's a perspective that I would add to that debate that's just not going to be on stage. None of those candidates in the first debate focused at all on this crippled institution of Congress because those guys are their buddies. They're insiders with them.
If one were cynical, one could conclude that the Democratic National Committee is itself conflicted, the conflict being that 100% of its constituency raises money through the campaign financing machine that we have now, and there is no benefit in it for rethinking the way that Democrats get elected to office. Are you, in fact, alleging that the DNC excluded you because you represent a threat to its very way of keeping the bills paid?
You know, many people have said that. I'm not going to say that because, you know, I think there's an easier way to understand what's going on here. The Democrats are fiercely trying to regain control of Congress. And in this world where we have an election every 2 years, the insiders can't ever think beyond the next election. It's like these guys are talking about what they're going to do when they get to Atlantic City, where the kids want to go to the boardwalk, the parents want to go to the beach, the uncle who happens to be an investment banker wants to go to the casino. But I'm the guy saying, look, the car has 4 flat tires and someone has stolen the battery to the car and we're not going to get anywhere until we fix this first. That's not a story they want to think about because this fundamental reform doesn't fit easily within the cycle of, you know, running to try to regain control of Congress. And that's exactly why I think outsiders inside this process are so important.
Before you withdrew from the race for the Democratic nomination, you also wrote about what you considered a pretty colossal tactical blunder. And that gets to your promise to your supporters that if they elect Larry Lessig, they can count on two things. President Lessig will secure campaign finance reform and then immediately resign. It seemed like a good idea at the time, not so much to you now, eh?
When you are given 3-minute, 5-minute chunks of time on cable news to explain what you're doing, and you have this feature of your plan, which includes resigning, that's the most attractive thing to be talking about. And that's the only thing that people wanted to talk about. What I'm talking about is getting elected, passing the most important democracy legislation in 50 years, and then once that's done, resigning. But nobody could get to that because they were so focused on this other part.
You allowed yourself to be caricatured as a novelty candidate, a joke candidate, playing some sort of performance art.
Whenever I would have more than 10 minutes or 15 minutes, nobody came away thinking that, you know, this was a joke idea, the idea of fixing the democracy. Like, the point about the blunder is, if you live in a media world where the attention span is tiny, there's only so much you can offer in a tiny bite-sized chunk.
All right, Larry, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Former candidate for the Democratic presidential nomination, Lawrence Lessig, teaches law at Harvard. Coming up, is Facebook the magic beans for the newspaper business? This is On the Media. This weekend, you'll receive with your paper a cardboard headset that you can use with a smartphone to watch a virtual reality film about children displaced by war. We'd like you to try this out and tell us what you think. As a news consumer, how did the virtual reality experience affect you? How did you feel about the story? Drawn in or disengaged, moved or manipulated? What potential or risk do you think virtual reality has for journalism? Record a voice memo on your smartphone and email it to otmproducer1@wnyc.org. We may get in touch or use your comment on the show. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. It's pretty easy to list the ruinous effects of digital revolution on the newspaper business. The obliterated classified ad sections, the infinite supply of competing content, driving down the value of adjacent advertising, ad blockers that directly block revenue, click-through rates on display ads that hover at close to zero, and slow loading of content and advertising on web and mobile that so frustrates users. And to all these problems, finally, perhaps, an answer. Social distribution. So now, another brief check-in on present and future business models to monetize the newspaper industry.
Present and future business models to monetize the newspaper industry.
Experiments on Google, Apple, Twitter, and especially Facebook all aim to enable papers to distribute their content directly via social channels. They harness both vastly larger audiences and, with the help of targeted data, maybe even higher ad rates. And as a bonus, pages load instantly, ensuring that the audience doesn't close out a page before it materializes on their phones. It's a potential bonanza, which is why many news organizations are dipping their toes into the social distribution waters, except for the Washington Post, which is cannonballing in with a large splash, announcing that it will feed 100% of its content to Facebook's instant articles in addition to its own website. That's a total of about 1,200 articles a day. Corey Hike is executive director of emerging news products for The Washington Post. Corey, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
I've been going around the world personally because this is my bête noire. The last 10 years telling people there are no magic beans. The financial model of newspapering is irrevocably broken. Now, I'm about to spend more or less the rest of this conversation trying to get you to admit that this is the end of the world as we know it. But first, would you tell me why this is the potential salvation that we've all been waiting for? Is this the magic beans?
Well, I like that you're saying magic beans and not silver bullet because beans is plural? Yeah, maybe. Are you looking for monetary salvation? Are you looking for new ways to tell stories kind of salvation? Are you looking for audience growth salvation? I actually think this does all of them. But the idea that the distribution will now be available and the understanding by the platforms that monetization is key and that we are important and we do need to stick around and these are avenues to help that. Yeah, there's some beans. We could use some more beans, but I have to say, I'm really, really optimistic.
However, can I get to the howevers, Corey?
I had a feeling you might.
Yeah, yeah. However, Facebook has a long and growing history of changing the rules in the middle of the game. At one time, they attracted businesses, for example, to build up likes and reach users organically through their news feeds. And then lo and behold, a little bit later, they said, no, well, actually, we're only going to feed your news to about 5% of the fans you've built up. But if you want to reach more of them, why, you can always buy advertising from Facebook. So isn't there a risk that eventually they're going to change the terms of the relationship?
They do that all the time. I think it's a mystery to folks that even work at Facebook. I don't feel like any of this is a real risk. I think the risk actually is to not try it. We really are working with Facebook to ask us questions about how things are working and what features we're interested in seeing. It's been a collaborative project that way. And so I feel pretty confident that we could flag something if it felt like it was risky or shaky for us or we were seeing a trend that we were alarmed about.
Well, as long as we're speaking of trends, let me just look a little bit over the horizon. We certainly know that Facebook's EdgeRank algorithm favors higher engagement, more sharing. And clearly, it's also in the Washington Post's financial benefit to get page views because that means advertising revenue. Will the Post have the incentive to veer off mission to produce more and more of what
EdgeRank is going to pass along to begin with, the rest of it being suppressed because it's just not tasty enough.
This is not a new concern for folks that like to talk about, you know, the potential threat of social and user controls on what people see and all of that. It certainly hasn't changed the kinds of content that we create and that we go after. It's actually given us a lot of opportunity.
I guess my question ultimately is, if a five-part series on, you know, maybe states cutting back Medicaid falls in the forest and everybody is on their smartphones reading about the Kardashians, does the first story make a noise?
When Twitter Moments launched a couple of weeks ago, one of the most popular moments that we produced was our Caliphate series. We did some really important reporting around that. Kevin Sullivan is a correspondent over there who did some work. And, you know, that's not necessarily one of the most read stories on our site, but it does get some traction, of course. And we did our best to promote that. And Twitter promoted that moment for us. And Kevin Sullivan gained close to 1,000 new followers on Twitter because of that. I feel pretty good about that. And I think that we can balance all of those things for sure.
I'm wondering, once you train people to go to Facebook for their news, or Google or Apple or Twitter, and they get accustomed to that, if you decide that it's threatening your editorial sovereignty at the Washington Post, can you ever train your own readers to go back?
Thinking about it in terms of, you know, our only goal is to have people come directly to us, it's myopic. That's not how any of this works anymore. You know, our core business of people subscribing to the Washington Post is, it's a strong one digitally, and it's growing. And a lot of that is happening by way of these other platforms. People that would have never been exposed are now being exposed and can make a decision about whether they'd like to become a subscriber or a more engaged user coming to us directly. It sounds like a pipe dream, but it's actually real. That's happening. We're definitely not shutting down our URL. I mean, not on my watch.
Is your watch an Apple Watch?
My watch is definitely an Apple Watch.
I want to ask you about Google and Facebook and Twitter as a group. They all kind of coalesced to create these new distribution mechanisms all at the same time. Suddenly, is this noblesse oblige? They're really interested in helping deliver journalism to citizens. They could have been developing buy buttons instead. Why all of a sudden these beans, magic or otherwise?
I simply think it's, in a word, mobile. That's where the growth is. And they saw that these audiences were consuming news. They weren't just reading all of the scary things that we're worried about them reading. The Kardashians, for example, we're just at a place where, as news organizations, we're pivoting to be more product-oriented in how we approach things and thinking about how we develop. And we've all built native apps at this point and understanding the importance of those. And it all kind of came together at the same time. We'd like to fix mobile. We see a real opportunity for better storytelling there because people actually want to consume it, and they are. So let's do it.
Corey, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Corey Hoik is Executive Director of Emerging News Products for The Washington Post. And now another optimist. David Chavern is the new president and CEO of the Newspaper Association of America, the trade group for that industry under siege. Unlike his predecessors, he has no roots in the media business. He comes from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, where he was the president of its Center for Advanced Technology and Innovation. Chavern brings with him a positive attitude based largely on his chamber years, where industries he represented had it so much worse. David, welcome to On the Media.
Great. Thank you very much for having me.
All right. Newsroom jobs have been cut in half, 30,000 lost positions since 1990. Ad revenue has been cut in half in the past 20 years. In one recent two-year period, 166 newspapers closed down or went web only. Many others declared bankruptcy. The value of news properties is pennies on the dollar compared to 20 years ago. Bot fraud and ad blockers are literally stealing billions of dollars from your members and their advertisers. So my question for you is, David, what was your blood alcohol level when you took this job?
Interestingly, when I first heard about the job, I actually was drinking wine. So maybe that did influence me. But listen, the reality is I'm a huge believer in the future of the newspaper industry and the news industry. And yes, they've gone through hard times. I mean, there's no denying that. But they're not the only industry that's ever gone through hard times and came out the other side.
We have met before, and when we discussed this, you talked about the airline industry. I thought that was an interesting observation.
Over the history of the airline industry from the 1930s onward, it's been a net destroyer of capital, right? I mean, people have lost more money than they made, and it's reached a new model. Now, it's not always a model that we love, right? I mean, it's too cramped. The food stinks. It's not like it used to be. But the fact of the matter is, when you and I were kids, flying was a rare and special luxury. Today, it's something that's widely available. People do it all the time, and it's affordable. And by the way, American Airlines had record profits last quarter.
Even though anybody would be crazy to get into the business.
Sure. If you want to go start an airline, God bless, look at history first. But the fact of the matter is, there are people that have made it to new models. And the future of the newspaper industry will look different than the past, but that's okay. I mean, the past was great, but there is a future.
Talk about pennies on the dollar. What newspapers fetch for display advertising online is a tiny fraction of what they used to fetch in the good old days for ads in their print publications. And, you know, on top of that, nobody ever clicks on those banner ads. The only clicking is done by robots, and ad blockers are deployed, cutting off your potential revenue at the pass. What news have you for your members to get them off the ledge?
They have an advantage in that they create something that's wanted and needed. I would argue that the market for long-form journalism is better than it's ever been. So everything you say about digital advertising is true. It is not unique to the news business. Anybody who has an advertising-supported model is wrestling with these same things. And the fact of the matter is, digital advertising is kind of in its infancy. Taking the ad model from publications, banner ads, for example, is an idea that came from publications, isn't translating well.
What do your members expect from you and from the Newspaper Association of America? What are they looking towards this trade organization to help them with?
It's basically three things. It's always three things, have you noticed? Someday I'll come up with four things or two things. But first and foremost, tell them the story. Newspaper industry is not dead, far from it, and it has got a vibrant future, and I'm willing to tell that story everywhere. Secondly, help them share knowledge. All of them are experimenting like crazy. They, particularly the smaller papers, want and need to know what the people with resources are doing and what they're finding that's working. And third is, we have a federal advocacy and lobbying practice. I am now a registered lobbyist, which I'm proud to state.
When you're out there lobbying, what are you lobbying for?
Press protections, it's copyright protections, it's fair use. It's a whole range of things that we have to keep up the messaging on, even if you have a circumstance like right now, for example, where there's not a lot moving in Congress.
While you were sitting in the green room, we spoke with Corey Hike of The Washington Post about what I call social distribution. And it's ways to cede some or all of your own distribution to a third party for greater reach and actually greater access to ad dollars. I asked Corey if she thought this was the magic beans that are going to lift the industry out of its travails. What are your thoughts?
First of all, I don't think there are any magic beans. What you have are the newspapers creating the news. And then you have the aggregators who have the audience, right? And the two can't avoid each other. News organizations can't just avoid the aggregator sites, because that is where a lot of people are and where a lot of potential audience members are. And on the other side of the coin, Google's not going to interview the mayor. They need the creation of that journalism. So what you're seeing is the stress back and forth of how do you create the economic arrangements that keep them both in the game.
They need you more than you need them, and vice versa.
Exactly.
David, I want to thank you very much and offer you, believe me, from the bottom of my heart, all the best of luck. David Chavern is the brand spanking new president and CEO of the Newspaper Association of America. Last Friday, ESPN announced it was closing Grantland,
a sports and culture website founded in 2011 by popular sports writer Bill Simmons. Simmons was fired earlier this year after a long history of run-ins with his ESPN bosses, most notably after calling NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell a liar. Though ESPN committed at first to keeping Grantland running, that commitment was short-lived. Amid budget cuts and layoffs, the unprofitable Grantland was both a luxury and a nuisance the self-proclaimed worldwide sports leader could live without. Robert Lipsight, a former New York Times reporter and ESPN's most recent ombudsman, laments the decision to close what he called, quote, a beacon in a sea of sludge. But, he says, Grantland never quite fit the ESPN mold.
Well, I think ESPN goes back and forth with its idea of class or prestige sites. It doesn't really know how to deal with it because it really understands that your basic ESPN consumer is a hardcore sports fan. Stereotypically, somebody who lives in the Mid-Atlantic, the southeastern states, who sits in the family room with the entire family to watch a game and becomes offended for the intrusion of what they call, quote, social issues. The biggest splash was when Michael Sam, the first openly gay football player to be drafted by the NFL, celebrated his being drafted with a kiss to his boyfriend. The ESPN cameras showed that long kiss. My mail went crazy over that. It was seen as liberal ESPN's attempt to inculcate their young people with the gay lifestyle. I think that ESPN understood all of that, that these currents of what seemed liberal to some, just aberrational to others, was not the direction of a sports media network.
There's a lot of shows on ESPN that are not actually game broadcasts themselves. They're sports news. But is what ESPN provides as its main product on SportsCenter and other programs really journalism?
No. What they really are is a way of churning up interest for the sporting events themselves. If there is an arrest for drunk driving or domestic violence, how is this going to affect the game on Sunday? That's what is considered journalism on ESPN, most of what is considered journalism on ESPN, and I don't consider it journalism.
What we're seeing is just an expression of a very, very large conflict of interest. ESPN pays billions of dollars to the leagues for the rights to broadcast their games. It earns billions more from advertising and cable fees for broadcasting the games. It owes its existence to these leagues, and yet it wants in some way or another to cover them journalistically. Is there any way around this structural conflict?
I think they have to find some way to spin off its investigative unit, the shows like Outside the Lines that are specifically geared towards hard, clear-eyed, smart journalism, and make that separation something that the audience will truly understand. The former host of College Game Day, Chris Fowler, once said that this is entertainment, and sometimes we have to, you know, check some of our sensibilities at the door. It's not going into the fact that on that particular day, the quarterback of Florida State is being investigated for rape. It's just about the joys and pleasures of a campus on game day.
When you took the job as ombudsman, you knew what you were getting into. You have been a viewer of the channel for years. You see the entertainment aspects, the promotional aspects, the snarky, semi-journalistic aspects. What did they tell you to make you want to venture into those swirling waters?
It's worse than that, Bob. I had, over the years, from time to time, worked for ESPN. Written for some of their shows, you know, gas bagged on others. But I think that I was excited by the possibility. I love the idea that they offered that I would be some sort of moral nudge to the network. I told them that I was going to be their window washer and offer a kind of transparency, you know, I thought that I could really make a difference. And what was important to me, more than making a difference, you know, to ESPN per se, was my feeling that sports is such an important definer of values in our culture. And ESPN is the basic window through which Americans get their sports information, that any kind of push towards progress for ESPN would be terrific.
So you went in there originally thinking, yes, you were going to be a window washer and shed some light on the inner workings of ESPN and hold your colleagues accountable for their work. How did it work out for you?
How did it work out for me? I'm, you know, coming out at the other end, I think that I felt I had been a piano player in a whorehouse, sure. But I think that I didn't really fully understand just how conflict of interest was embedded in ESPN's DNA. And that was my mistake. They're basically doing what they think that they should be doing, which is presenting sports entertainment to America. I think if there's anything that they shouldn't be doing, it's purporting to be covering sports with any consistency of journalism.
Bob, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Robert Lipsight is the former ombudsman for ESPN. Coming up, Alec Baldwin talks about everything under the sun. This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Last Friday at the Wharton School in Philadelphia, I convened a day-long Media Future Summit of bosses and owners from throughout the media and marketing universe, all trying to figure out how to keep the lights on. What follows is an edited version of my conversation with our luncheon keynote speaker. As you face your audio device, he's the one on the left.
Alec Baldwin is a multimedia star, producer, and an activist. He isn't a powerful media boss, but he played one on TV. On 30 Rock, his Jack Donaghy was a besieged network executive willing to make any and all compromises for the sake of the bottom line. So it's pretty much a documentary. Anyway, what's happening here when Alec joins us is that I'm going to interview him about his hopes and fears for the media future. And for his podcast, Here's the Thing, Alec is going to interview me right back. I can't promise that this is going to be seamless or even coherent, but you will be witnessing some hot, hot two-way action. Ladies and gentlemen, put your hands together for Mr. Alec Baldwin.
Thank you for having me. I'm here, by the way, because I'm a big fan of his. I listen to On the Media, and I admire Bob, and I like how Bob gives them hell, so to speak, on the radio.
You are a great American. I'm going to go first, all right?
Sure.
All right. In the past 2 weeks, without even the benefit of a Google search, I have seen you reported on in the media 3 times. One was a Daily Mail paparazzi spread of you and your wife walking your infant in New York. Another was a scoop saying you won't be appearing in a film that a previous scoop had said you'd be appearing in. And the third was an in-depth takeout on your eldest daughter's tattoo. Now, understanding that celebrity, by definition, demands a certain surrender of privacy, how can you even sit here talking about the media without having a stroke or, at the very least, a grand mal seizure?
Well, there's the media, obviously, for people who are consumers of the media, myself, other people who, you know, I have a media diet of public radio and the New York Times and whatever online and the Journal and so forth. And then there's people who are subjects of the media for better or worse in whatever way, which, and which everything you mentioned there is just, you know, some silly nonsense. But It's very difficult to separate my feelings about the media between the two. So, for example, when I lived in Los Angeles, I loved the Los Angeles Times. I admired the Los Angeles Times. The Los Angeles Times had, this is, and by the way, all this is opinion, my opinion. The Los Angeles Times, I thought, had wonderful coverage of Sacramento and the state of California. Their Sacramento page, their California pages was great reporting. And they covered Sacramento in a way that the New York Times refuses to cover Albany. And so I love the L.A. Times. Whenever I'm in Los Angeles, I read the L.A. Times. Right up until a woman in the L.A. Times wrote this scathing article about me in the paper, filled with all kinds of, you know, invective and opinion and so forth. And it's interesting how literally one affects the other. I sit there and I go, well, I'm not reading the L.A. Times anymore. I just don't. They're just off my media list now. You know what I mean? It's kind of silly, I mean, in a way, but the two do contaminate the other. They do contaminate the other. And I want to ask you, one of the things that drew me to listen to your show, I mean, On the Media would come on, was your acerbicity, if you will. You know, you're a tough guy. I send people links to your piece about the White House Correspondents' Dinner, which I used to attend, and it was one of those events you'd be standing there going, why am I here, really? Why am I at the White House Correspondents? I really don't get it. This is a kind of a, maybe not a very strong question, but like, why do you continue to do what you do and be on that field suited up and observing the media when you could just go and teach somewhere and write books and not have to really be on the front line of it that much? Why do you keep doing what you're doing?
I don't really care to come in.
Seriously.
Seriously. We try to understand how the media works and try to figure out what's wrong with it. But, you know, I think everybody in America, especially on the Republican Party, believe the media is corrupted in any number of ways. And we don't necessarily disagree, but we institutionally as a program believe what's wrong with the media have nothing to do with what people think is wrong with the media. And a lot of that is wrong with the media, especially journalism, is laziness, pack mentality, the tendency towards stenography when covering major institutions in government as opposed to really hardcore journalism, and false balance, the false equivalency, which in bending over backwards to try to create objectivity with a capital O gives equal time to two sides that are not themselves intrinsically equal, like trying to cover the vaccine issue as if it were a scientific debate, like giving global warming deniers equal time with science and so forth, which has turned everything with the media's aiding and abetting every issue, including things that can be measured through science, turned everything into a political argument. And the world should not be viewed solely from an ideological or political perspective. Some things are just facts. And it infuriates me when some sort of artificial construct of neutrality ignores readily apparent facts. So does that help?
Well, the media has become like my primary business, which is in film. We would sit there 25 years ago and a movie would come out with Arnold Schwarzenegger and someone would make some disparaging comment. You know, a bunch of people who just got off the boat from New York and had just carried a spear at the Delacorte, and they're here in Hollywood, and they make some disparaging comment about Schwarzenegger. And the producer of our film would turn to us and say, don't do that. And everyone would kind of rear back. And he'd say, no, no, don't do that, or she. And they'd say, don't do that. Because when Arnold goes to work, 300 people in this business go to work on high-paying, skilled union jobs, makeup, hair, drivers, payroll, accounting, location managers, on-set craft, cinematography, you name it, set design. And P.S., when Arnold's movie cycles out and all the revenue comes in and he's made $300 million in profit for Warner Brothers, $30 million of that, 10%, goes into a research and development budget that's going to develop the next movie you're in. So all of us sit there and go, you know, that's a good point. There's a lot of jobs at stake. You know, when I was at MSNBC, someone took me aside and said to me, you have to understand, no one's watching this station. She goes, however, a lot of veteran people who live in New York, in the New York area, who have children in private school, she said this to me this way, she said, have children in private school, We are veteran news people who have jobs in television news. We've all worked somewhere else in more serious capacities. We all have jobs here because Phil Griffin created his hocus pocus that, you know, with carriage fees and whatever, where we all have a job here. So she literally looked at me and she went, shh. She said, don't complain about the sets and the, you know, all your complaining about how you want to make your show different from everything, which we did. We came in and we said, let's try to do something a little different than your shows where all the sets look like, you know, Soviet police stations and so forth. I said, she was trying to help me, and she did help me, which was, everybody there, don't rock the boat. And that's kind of what's happening. My biggest complaint about what's happening in media, if you pressed a button and turned it all off that wasn't really worthy, you'd be killing a lot of jobs, I think. So can I ask you one now? When you talk about the chasm, if you will, between people's perception of what's wrong with the media and what's really wrong with the media, you know, for me, one of the biggest problems is that we don't have a place where people can go enough, I think, to have that conversation that's meaningful. You know what I mean? Where there's some kind of a forum. I mean, here we are in a room to have a serious discussion. Hopefully we can be lighthearted about it, about media. But where does it exist? The things that you object to in media, or the things that trouble you in media, where does it exist, the opportunity to remedy that and fix that today? Where in the business or in academia or anywhere?
Yeah, I think you've hit the nub of the problem. We've been at it for 15 years, and I think we've done a really good job identifying flaws in the particulars and in trends and in sort of institutional structural problems. And we don't simply limit ourselves to media. We look at government and politics and civil liberties and really the society as a whole. But we're really, really good, if I may say, at identifying problems. And we're pretty good at getting people all pissed off. And they go on our comment section, and either they say, you are commies, or they say, you know, right on, because they're fellow travelers, and they perceive us as just another political voice. And when you realize that you're trying to do a rigorous, vigorous, serious approach at understanding problems and their provenance, and then you're just being perceived as just another voice from somewhere on the political spectrum, there's a tendency to want to curl up in the fetal position and just kind of whimper. Because you're really not contributing to anything. You're just giving other people an opportunity to huff and puff.
People still rely on you to tell the truth. They want you to tell them what's going on. In my lifetime, the number of people who want what you said, they want an articulation of their political view of the world to medicate them with. They wanted some pre-digested pablum that Fox provides for their audience. You know, there is no liberal equivalent. Who was that? Alan Combs. I mean, good God, that poor guy. What a thankless job that was to be the liberal half of that show with that horse's Hannity. I mean, who's a bigger horse's than Sean Hannity? He's the greatest horse's in the history of media.
Let me ask you a question, Alec. How would you characterize Sean Hannity?
Well, as they taught me in Washington when I went to college, I would employ the language of the 19th century legislators. I have the least amount of high regard for my colleague from Fox News.
Let me ask you one more thing.
Sure.
Because this is about media revenue and about the financing of news and information and the financing of entertainment and infotainment. They are all pretty much in jeopardy. As someone with a foot in both worlds, I want to know, which do you think, which crisis, the financing crisis for entertainment or the financing crisis for journalism, is going to have actually the biggest impact on the society, make America feel worse?
I don't know about feel worse, but I think, like, in entertainment, I think the next thing to crumble will be the bundling of television channels, the way we currently purchase television channels, and we'll get to a full-blown a la carte ordering of television, and you'll be able to call up your menu of channels you want piped into your home by satellite or by cable, and, I don't know, maybe a third of the stations that are on TV right now will go out of business. Or they'll be created in some other way. They'll stream online. You know, you'll have some other presence, like MSNBC. I mean, the MSNBC may go out of business. No, I don't say that with any malice. But Yeah, that's a big thing that's going to happen in TV in this country. There's a lot of TV now that that skates along with this kind of packaging that they do and bundling they do, and they have minimal audiences. As far as entertainment is concerned, I had a guy say to me that the Times is going to change radically in the next couple of years, maybe, let's say 10 years, that unless they get even more digital sales, you're going to have like a single section New York Times. That's going to be news, international and national news and business news, and everything else will be online. Entertainment and arts will be online. Sports will be online. Metro will be online for New Yorkers, which is a shame because I'm somebody who I don't feel the need to apologize because I don't want to be reading the New York Times on a device I have to charge all the time. I'm old school and I like having a copy of the paper under my arm and reading the paper, and where we're going to be, everything's going to be devices, I think, limits things for some people. But what do you predict is going to happen along those lines in media?
I foresee a sea of hurt and a lot of very disappointed venture capitalists and even more disappointed public shareholders who have been sold a bill of very bad goods by the venture capitalists who got out just in time. But at the same time, I think we're going to see an incredible amount of content that we never hitherto imagined would be available to us. It's all going to be paid for by investors betting on the come, and they're never going to get paid off. And at some point, the appetite of investors to fund this stuff speculatively will probably disappear. Then will come a whole lot of consolidation, and we'll be left with what we're left with. And I just hope the New York Times has more than one section, because I depend on those blue plastic bags to walk my dog with. This man is making a film in New York. He dropped everything. He came down here. He has not charged us a dime. He did it because he believes in the future of media. It was the most gracious gesture. I give you Alec Baldwin.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Kimmy Regler, Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, and Jesse Brenneman. We had more help from Alex Friedland and Dasha Lizitsina. And our show was edited this week by our executive producer, Katya Rogers. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Casey Means. Jim Schachter is WNYC's Vice President for News. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. This week, I lost my dear brother and good friend. This is for Josh. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.